One of the subjects that comes out of the parshas that we're reading now, particularly this week's parsha, is the question of ordeals and coping with them. There's a fundamental aspect of Torah, and it's the reason that the Torah begins with the first experience of the human being being in fact a test or an ordeal, and it's the reason that the beginning of the Jewish people, which is the pathway or the journey of Avraham Avinu, which is what we read about now, that is also the first point, is in fact a test, the challenge to leave where you are and move to a new place, which is the prototypal journey of self-discovery, self-elevation. And it's the test that is really at the root of all of our tests. So let's spend a little time together, try to work out this area, the nature of tests or ordeals, what we call nisayon. See if we can try to understand. Very, very difficult area. Full of paradox. It's a real challenge. First of all, let's ask a few questions about this area. You know that Ramchal says that it's the fundamental reason for being here in the first place is to be tested. Now, the non-Jewish world probably thinks that the reason you're here, if there is any purpose, is to seek happiness or whatever it is that they think. But our concept of the purpose of life is to face ordeals. That's what it says. The Ramchal says that the three reasons you're created is to perform mitzvahs, asos mitzvahs, la'avod, which means to serve, v'la'amod b'nisayon, to stand strong in ordeals, to be tested and to succeed in tests. So the purpose of being created is to succeed in tests, then it pays to understand it. We do have a concept of happiness and that being an essential ingredient in moving along the path, but our concept of happiness is not that it's the goal, but rather it is the product of moving correctly. One is growing correctly and happiness will be the result. The expression on the face may not necessarily be one of joy, just like when somebody doing a back-breaking, agonizing labor may have an inner sense of tremendous fulfillment and achievement as the thing takes shape, even though the face may be contorted in pain. We understand that moving along our the path that is the path of personal, unique self-expression, that the byproduct of that process is happiness. But it's not the end, it's not the end in itself. We're not trying to be happy, we're trying to succeed in the tests that are given to us. Now, this concept of being tested raises a number of questions and paradoxes. Let's try to work through them and see where it takes us. We've studied many times together in this forum the idea that whatever the Torah contains or teaches is always implicit in the words themselves. That's the basic axiom. By now we should all be experts in using these techniques. Among the other principles that we've learned, which are the principles of deriving the depth of the concepts of Torah, one of the basic principles is that the word that the Torah uses for anything in the world contains all that thing contains. Without going again into all the background, just a very brief reference to it, the reason is that our concept is that the world was created by the words themselves. Our concept of the creation is that Hashem, God, created the world by saying it into existence. His words were not instructions. The secular notion of what the Bible means when it talks about His words is that He gave instructions. He said, let this happen, let that happen, and then someone else, some angels or underlings, got busy and produced what it was that He was instructing them to do. But that's not the concept. The deeper concept is that He simply said the words, and His words became those objects. And His word crystallized or condensed or concretized into the object that it denotes. Our language is only a description. When we say a word, it connotes something that you know I mean because you already understand that that word indicates that thing. But that's not Lashon Kodesh. Lashon Kodesh means that the word is the thing. The best example of this, of course, is that the word in the Torah for a word and the word in Hebrew for an object is the same word. I don't think there's any other language like that on earth. The word for a word in Hebrew is davar, and the word for any object or phenomenon or experience or anything on earth is davar. And the reason that those two map to each other is because any word in the Torah is in fact the object that it describes. Any object in the world is none other than the word that the Torah uses which generates that object. Of course, there are many offsprings, corollaries of this idea. One of them is that the world should be a dialogue. If every object in the world is none other than a word of the Torah, then the world becomes a dialogue. It should be listening. But that's another story for another time. The essence is that there's an ineffable, indivisible light that is shone from a source that's beyond our comprehension, beyond our capacity, beyond our permission even to think about, and that light shines through the Torah. The Torah is a filter or a film that refracts and projects and diffracts the light that is falling upon it, that is shining through it onto the screen, which is the world. Anything that is on the film will appear on the screen. Anything that's on the screen must have been there on the film. Anything that's in the Torah must appear in the universe. Anything that's in the universe must appear in the Torah. And the word that the Torah uses for this object will be exactly what that object is. And there can be no discrepancy. Everything that the thing has, it has because the word says it. And of course it means you can study either. You can study the Torah and know the world, or you can study the world and know the Torah. You go either way. In this generation, we don't study the world to know the Torah because we don't have the clarity of mind to come up with the right conclusions. There's no telling what our twisted minds would come up with in terms of the explanation of the point of origin when we see the results. We don't do that. We study the origin, and hopefully we project it correctly into objective perception of reality. But that's not the point. The point is that one reflects the other perfectly. And therefore, any word that you wish to consider in Torah will have all of the aspects of the object or the experience or the phenomenon. And that's a basic axiom, and we never move from that. And therefore, the first technique that we use when we wish to explore anything in the world, in Torah, we look at the word that the Torah is using for that thing. And the word that the Torah uses for ordeals is fascinating. The Torah's word, Hebrew word, for a test or an ordeal is the word nisayon. 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 The problem with that word is it's based on the root nes, which means a miracle. That's the problem. The root meaning of the concept of being tested is that something miraculous happens. Now that is very challenging. What's the miracle when you're tested? You put under pressure, put tremendous pressure, but you come through, you fail or you succeed. Where's the miracle? You succeed in a test, not miraculous. Surely you reveal that you are capable of success. Maybe enormously difficult, tremendously painful, take tremendous courage and moral and emotional, but where's the miracle? The definition of that which is miraculous is that something which is impossible happens. There's nothing inaccurate in the words of Torah or the sages. If the Torah uses the word nisayon based on the concept of a miracle to convey the essence of a test, we have to understand that. Now that's a challenge. The word nes literally in Hebrew, literally, perhaps its most literal meaning, means it means a banner or a flag or a standard that is uplifted. Not like kenes al hagibah, like a banner on the hill. The root actually means to uplift. It actually means to uplift or to raise high. But a flag or a banner is something that is raised above the surrounding territory, so that in the confusion of battle or in the confusion of a mess of people who cannot see, beyond their immediate limitations, when the flag is raised, there's a rallying point that, again, is a point of centrality and of organization. You suddenly, and that's what a miracle is. In the mess of the phenomena of the world, you can get lost. Get lost, you can forget that there's one central organizing principle, and therefore when that which is miraculous occurs, there's a rallying point, the concepts are all straightened out, the values are reorganized, and you see what's happening. We don't see miracles in our generation, we only see hidden miracles. We don't see revealed miracles. There are two classes of nes, and that's not tonight's subject. We do not see the revealed miracles of laws of physics and science being controverted. We only see the hidden miracles of incredible coincidence, so-called coincidence. And that's another discussion about the nature of miracles. It's not tonight's discussion. But the point is, the fact remains, that which is miraculous reorganizes and reorients your values correctly, because you see the real energy behind things is that which transcends the natural. It's an uplifted banner or a flag, and that's what it is. But the essence of that which happens, which is miraculous, is that it's impossible. The reason you see that Hashem is operating here is because you know that without him this could not have happened. That's what the, now what does that have to do with being tested? What does that have to do with an ordeal, a success, even an incredibly difficult ordeal? When you pass the test, what's the element of miracle? Now, that's our problem. That's our problem. Let's go further. When you test it, faced with an ordeal, given a test. Tremendous test, going through something that other people don't go through, don't understand why you were singled out for this thing, why me. All those enormous feelings of incapacity and the fact that this is too big for me, and you're faced with a test. Question you have to ask is this test pitched beyond your level, or is it pitched within your level, right? Stay with me carefully. If I reach a certain level in an area of my life, right, my spiritual greatness, my spiritual development has reached a certain level, and now I meet a test. Is the test that's pitched, is it pitched beyond my level, or is it pitched within my level? Am I capable of overcoming this thing that I'm being asked to overcome, or am I not capable of it? In other words, if I've reached this level, and I turn the corner and I walk into a test, not talking about tests that you choose yourself, or deals that you take on yourself, have got nothing to do with discussion. That's completely forbidden. And the Torah concept is that if you choose a test, you failed already. Even if you pass the test, you will have failed. If you choose a test, you've broken the first rule of being tested. You may not choose a test. It's a fundamental failure. It's not just unwise. At a superficial level, when you ask to be tested, at a superficial level, it's unwise. You may choose a test and wade into a danger that is more than you can handle. When he gives you a test, he chooses one that he knows you'll be successful in, if you try. That means he matches it up appropriately to your level. We'll have to discuss whether it's above, it's beyond it. But he chooses, he knows what you're capable of. But the way the Kabbalistic sources put it, is that when a farmer has a load to carry to market, he doesn't load it on the animal that can't carry the load. If he has a load to carry, he puts it on that one of his animals that can carry the load. When Hashem loads you with a burden and a load, he gives you one that you're capable of or carry. When he chooses your test, he knows what he's doing. But if you choose your test, you wade into danger, and you choose a test, there's no telling what will happen. You may well have bitten off more than you can chew, no guarantees. But there's a much more fundamental reason for not being able to, for not being allowed to choose tests, and hopefully we'll have to work it out this evening. There's a lot of thinking that has to go into this, but let's try and stay together. We're not talking about tests that you choose yourself. Okay? The fundamental failure in ordeals is to have taken on the ordeal in the first place, to have asked for a difficulty, to have asked for a moral challenge, to walk into a situation of moral temptation, yeah, and then overcome it. You fail on so many levels, even if you succeed. First of all, the Balaam must say that even if you succeed, instead of walking out, you walk out of the test with one of two kinds of failure. Either you'll fail it and you'll fall into what's called taiva, that means you'll give into the temptation, or you'll overcome it and you'll fail in what's called gaiva, you'll walk out and say, made it. But that error is fundamental. As I understand this, in principle, it's not just that superficially it's unwise. Let's try and work through this. Let's leave for the moment tests that you ask for yourself. We'll come back to that. Anybody with any sense that every morning we say, "Ba'al tavienu lo lidei nisayon," do not bring us to test. The Masilas Yisharim says the only way you can grow in the world is by being tested. So surely you should walk out into all sorts of moral difficulty all day. Go and look for situations that are tempting morally, immorally. And see if you can overcome them. That's how you grow. So, anybody has any sense, every morning you ask Hashem not to give you any tests. The tzaddik says to Hashem, you keep the test and you keep the reward. Just don't let me do any damage in your world. And even a person who's not a tzaddik and is thinking about himself and not only Hashem's gilui in the world, such a person also doesn't wade into tests. Because who wants to play with fire? If you have poison at home, You make sure to put it on the table next to the wine to see if you'll remember. You know, drink the wine, don't drink the poison. Need your head ready if you do that. You poison, you throw it out, you lock it up, you don't stay with fire. If you have two roads, one of which has a cobra poised to strike, and the other is a safe road, what sort of person takes the road where the cobra is? You don't do that, you take the safe road. The Gemara says that if a person takes a road where there's an ordeal, the example the Gemara says talks about a man who comes to a fork in a road, and on that fork, those two roads, one of them gets him home. And the other takes him past a place where there are women who are immodestly exposed. The women are washing or doing some washing in a river. If you look at those women, again, we're talking about normal men, not this generation. We're talking about a situation where those things are considered ideal, not the fallen version of the search for thrills of this generation. This person comes to that situation, he knows that's not good, it will represent a fall in his spiritual level. So he says to himself, well, if I take the road where there's no ordeal, just get home. If I take the road where the temptation is, and I hold strong and do not look, surely I'm doing what I'm in the world for, and I will have grown. So Gemara says, if he takes the road where the women are, and does not look, he's called a rasha, an evil man. Now, he passed the test. He didn't pass the test. Not only did he fail the test, he failed even to identify that he was being tested. The test is not whether you'll look or not, the test is which road will you take. At the point of having his choice, not only did he failed even to identify the fact that he was being tested. This man's looking for drama. A dramatic test. No mitzvah in the Torah to be dramatic. Mitzvah in the Torah to be safe. But there's a fundamental error here. It's not just that it's unwise and it's misunderstanding or a misreading of your capacity. There's a much more fundamental error. Let's try and work through it. So let's ask this question. When a test is given to you, not a test that you choose, a test that's given to you, is it pitched at your level or is it pitched beyond your level? Now, if it's pitched at your level, so then you'll be able to succeed. There's no guarantee you will, of course. That's up to you. That's what free choice means. No guarantees here. But there's a guarantee that you can. Logical. If it's in your level, not more than you, it's within your capacity, at your level or below. So, if you make enough effort, you'll overcome it. Yeah? The problem is that cannot be called miraculous. The word nisayon that's based on nes, like we said before, which means miracle, is inappropriate. And the words that Torah uses for things always have to be the essence of the thing. On the other hand, if you say that I'm given a test that is beyond my level, it's more than I can handle at present, then if somehow I manage to overcome it, it will be a very appropriate use of the word miracle. But the question is, you can't do that which is impossible. Why would he give you more than you can handle? That's our dilemma. Are we together? Very few, very, very few notes. But that's our problem. If a test is pitched beyond your level, it's truly beyond what you can cope with, it is impossible for you, so then it will be called miraculous if you somehow get there. Marvelous. Definitely miraculous. But you can't do the impossible. And on the other hand, if it's pitched within your level, then we understand how you'll manage. But that's not miraculous. And there's a further depth here. Listen well, if it's pitched within your level and you manage, you will not have grown. Again, if the point of being here is to grow beyond what you were before, so that tomorrow you're greater than you are today, and if every test will always be pitched within your level of capacity, so then even if you pass all your tests, you'll never grow. You may achieve your maximum potential, but you can never. There's no possibility of transcendence. The maximum you'll ever be able to do is bring out the fullness of your capacity. But that's not, the Torah is a spiritual path. It means transcending. Transcendence means you do that which is more than was possible before. That's called genuine growth. And of course it means that there are no limits. If tests are always pitched within your level, and you overcome them, and you overcome everyone, but there's a limit, there's a ceiling, you're limited. A fantastic achievement if you pass all your tests and you bring out all your capacity, but there's a ceiling. That's not what the spiritual world is all about. Spirituality means a lack of limitations, that you can do anything. So we're forced to say that a test is pitched beyond your level of capacity somehow, which is why the Torah calls it miraculous. But we need to understand how that works. Miraculous will be appropriate. Genuine growth will be appropriate. But what's going on? Let's ask another question. One of the most basic questions that even children ask, certainly anybody who has a Beis Yaakov background or a young boy in yeshiva or any thinking young Jew, anybody who's ever read Bible, Torah in any form, must ask this question. And the question is, the Torah phrases tests as if Hashem is testing a person to see whether he will succeed or not. The words very openly suggest that. It says that God tests Abraham, the test in this week's parsha is Lech Lecha, leave your birthplace, your land, your father's house, go to the land which I will show you. And the Mefarshim say that the real test was that he didn't tell him where to go. He said go, but he didn't tell him where. That's a test. You have to leap into the unknown. You don't know what the destination is. Many other elements of being tested there as well. Avraham Avinu went through 10 tests, the 10th of which was having to kill his own child. So the fundamental question is this. Why would God test you if he knows beforehand what you're capable of? I mean, you read the superficial words of Torah without an adult's understanding, as unfortunately most of us do. The words of Torah say that he tested him as if to see, like a teacher tests a student. The teacher tests a student to see what the student knows. So Hashem is testing us in order to discover what it is that we're capable of. And furthermore, not only does he know what we're capable of, but since he lives outside of time, he knows what we will do in that test. Not just what we are capable of doing, but he knows what we will do. He's outside of time. The future to him is the same as the past, same as the present. And therefore, when he tests Avraham Avinu, surely he knows beforehand exactly what he will do in that test, and therefore, why is he testing him? That's an absolute beginner's question. It has to be answered. Now let's try and find our way through this difficult area by trying to understand what exactly is going on. The way to do it is this. Let's take one of the questions that we've asked and use that as the framework, if you like, on which to build an approach to the subject. Let's choose one of our questions, not to get confused. See if we can answer that question. And from there, Mr. Shem will be able to answer the whole, understand the whole subject. Let's take the last one, simplest, the most obvious, the beginner's question. Why would Hashem test someone if he knows beforehand whether he will succeed or not? Now, the classic answer to this question, please stay carefully with me. There's a classic answer that's given to this question. I'd like to show you that it's inadequate. It's not enough. It's true, and it's wonderful, and it's deep, and when you see it written in the sources that talk about it, and children are usually given this, young people are usually given this answer. It's wonderful, it's essential to understand, it can change your life. But I'd like to show you that despite its depth and its beauty, it doesn't go far enough. That there's another hidden layer beneath this which an adult has to understand. The answer that's usually given is this. You know why Hashem tests Avram? He doesn't test him because he needs to know what he's capable of. He knows what you're capable of anyway. The problem is that you don't. That's the problem. He knows what you're capable of, but you don't. The test is to reveal to yourself what you can, not to him. Obviously he gets nothing out of your test. Obviously he knows beforehand what you're capable of. The question is, you don't. You need to learn what you're capable of. You need to bring it up. You need to discover it or reveal it or realize or actualize your potential. That's why you're given a test. After you do it, you realize there's a capacity. You brought into the real from the world of the potential. Let's understand this. This is not enough. There's only a first step. True, but it's only a first step. But let's study it for a few moments. What does it mean? What does it mean exactly? The concept is that life consists of two facets. One is called potential and one is called actual. Like we call b'koyach and b'poel. B'koyach means that which could be. It lies dormant within the capacity. And b'poel means that which is being brought out and realized and manifest. The purpose of the creation of the world is to bring that which could be into that which is. The purpose of the creation of the world is to translate that which could manifest into that which actually is. The purpose of the creation of the human being is to give you the opportunity to take that which you could be and bring it into the real and become it. To translate your potential energy into actuality. That's the purpose of creation. Why is this? Not clear that we can understand why it is. We observe that that's the nature of reality. We see that the soul, some sources, people often ask, why was the human soul not created as a disembodied spiritual entity that floats around in the spiritual world? Why does it have to come into a body, into the world of practical, finite, tangible limitation? After all, the body is a tremendous contradiction to the neshama. The body is physical and earthly. It contains its own excrement. It's given to disintegration. It's very problematic. A soul doesn't want to be put into a body. Shama doesn't want to meet up and bond with a body. Thus, because in the Shama, in the spiritual world, is only potential energy. It's only a potential human being. It's the ability to become a human being. But when it's put into a body and it's locked in and bound up with the physical tissue of a body, it's a real person. Put more plainly, when you come into the world in your body, you have tools that you can use to make a difference. But when you're identified as that, so to speak, part of Hashem in the spiritual source, there's no achievement, there's nothing that's been built. It's only what could be. It's a theory, it's a potential, it's a possibility, that's all. But when you're differentiated, brought down into the world, you inhabit a body, you have a lifetime of challenges, difficulties, and you bring out your capacity, then you become what you must become. Why he needed this in the first place, perhaps beyond our understanding. In fact, the sources that ask this question most deeply, in the Kabbalistic sources, they ask the question of why he created the world in the first place, and answer that we don't know why, but we observe that he found it necessary not just to be able to create the world, but to actually do it. We understand from this that he demonstrates that what's necessary is the translation of potential into action. Why is beyond us, but we see that that's the pathway. Incidentally, in our own psychology we see this. You know that, again, we've remarked before that one of the tools of delving into these deeper areas in Torah is to understand that everything that is in the higher world, we are given a tangible example in our own emotions. That means that in your own emotional makeup, in your own experience of life, there's always something that you can feel and know automatically. That's the example that you're meant to use to get to the thing that you don't know automatically. Right? You want to know that the physical world looks like a superficial and physical world, but unseen and inside it has a spiritual reality. You have an example, a human being. Human being, when you relate to a person, all you ever see is the body. All you can ever apprehend of a human being is the body. But the body is enough, if you study it carefully, to see that there's someone inside. And that's what a relationship is. Relationship is not just being in proximity to a body. It's using the movements and the subtleties of expression of the body to perceive that there's someone inside, even though you never see that tangibly. You take that as an experience to go study the world and teach yourself to observe that in the world there's also something that moves. Everything that you require to make us with Hashem, for example, that the purpose of life, what you're striving for and your neshama is longing for, is a bonding and ecstatic oneness with Hashem. Who could begin to relate to that? Who could begin to relate to that? Bond me with marriage. Given marriage. The nature of what marriage is, what marriage should be, is the bonding into oneness of two separate things. There's a natural ability to feel that. The experience is alive and rich and tangible. It's the beginning of the experience of learning what the relationship with Hashem is. And it goes throughout the experiences of life. Anything that you expect it to relate to that transcends, you give it a natural example. The human psyche has a natural feeling that which you can do in life, there's a pressure to do. People are not happy to think to themselves, well, I could have done this and this and this and this, but who needs it? There's a drive in the human soul to express that which could be. In fact, sometimes it's even extreme. People go to certain places where they can do certain things. They have a tremendous conflict because they can't do it all. Why do you have to do it all? I don't know, but you go on vacation. You wake up in the morning. You've got one day in this place. You could climb the mountain. You could swim in the lake. You could canoe on the river. You could ride the horses. Tremendous frustration. In fact, most people lie probably half the day fantasizing about all of them. No? But it doesn't start doing one of them because human immaturity is such that when you start one of them, all the others suddenly seem more attractive. Why? Because there's a pressure that has to be done, and there's a tragedy that you can't do it all. There's a drive in the emotions to realize, actualize. There's a drive to travel because people want to say that they've done it, they've been there. When they're there, they don't enjoy it. They're so busy taking pictures to prove afterwards that they were there to other people who weren't, they don't even look. Why is there this need to have been every place on earth? People say, no, I've been there. I've done that. I've done it. People do stupid things. You'll be able to say you've done it. Somewhere deep inside, there's a knowledge that the world is given to be actualized, that your interaction with every aspect and facet of the world is there to be brought into reality. And therefore, the concept here is that a test is that which gives you the opportunity and squeezes you to reveal to yourself that of which you are capable. It helps you and it pressurizes you to bring your hidden potential into the actual. Now, let's take this further. Let me give you a graphic representation of this. The reason, the result of this, is that what gets squeezed into actuality, what you pressurize to reveal, is that which was hidden to you before. That's what we're saying. There was a capacity that you had, but you didn't know. He puts you under pressure so that you can reveal this. What it means is the following. Let's assume, this is how I'm going to jump over this thing. Yes? I'm going to take it around. I'm not going to do it. I mean, there was a time that I could. But you're going to jump over something. You're standing in this field, practicing jumping over objects. So you set up the object you're going to leap over, and you run and you leap over it. And after a lot of practice, you define for yourself the highest object that you can clear. Yes? And you try desperately to get higher, but you can't clear anything more than that. You exercise, you train, you practice, you reach a limit. After a while, you're standing there psyching yourself up for another attempt, and you're going to try to clear it by one extra centimeter. And while you're standing here, a noise behind you. You turn around and racing across the field towards you is a raven bull. Tons of meat. With razor sharp horns. And it's not a mistake, it's about meat one. And it's coming at a great rate. You will gracefully sail over something much higher than this without any problem. There's a high fence around the field. You totally forget about this and find yourself on the other side of the fence. There's much. You couldn't do that before. You end up on the other side of the fence. What's going on here? What's going on is that this wasn't your limit. This wasn't your limit. This was a limit under normal circumstances. But there was another. There was a depth beyond it that given enough terror or pressure. And people will tell you, if you study events, things that happened during the war, or that happened to people under threat of life and death, or perhaps the threat to a child, people have done things that are physically impossible. Certainly impossible under normal circumstances. The pressure of an ordeal, the pressure of an nisayon, squeezes you to bring out that which is beyond your normal capacity that you didn't know. After you've done this, you realize that this wasn't your level. There's something much more that you're capable of. That's the idea of a nisayon. It's a pressure to bring out and evince and manifest and realize, actualize in the world that which was hidden. But, this is not enough. Because, let's stay together carefully. This is the answer that's usually given. But it's inadequate. Because what's happening here is not miraculous. It's not miraculous. Why? Because this is my level. This is my revealed level. Right? Under terror and pressure, I'll get higher. But there's a limit to that. There's a limit to that. There's a limit. I don't know what the limit is, but there's a limit. In other words, if you set a whole herd of terrifying things towards me. There's a certain kind of fence I won't get over, no matter what. That's called your genuine level. Yeah, there are two levels. There's that which you know of, your revealed level, and there's another limit. There's another level which is limited, which is maybe immensely higher than you ever realized, but there's a limit. That's your genuine limit. If a test is pitched within that zone, it cannot be called miraculous. Is this clear? Not a miracle. You didn't know you were capable, but you were. A miracle is that which is not possible, not which you didn't know, but impossible. That which you've never been pressurized into doing is not impossible, you just don't know about it. This answer doesn't go far enough. If the word nisayon is going to mean that which is miraculous, then we are going to have to say, like it or not, understand it or not, that there's a level that you're capable of, and there's another level which is your true limit. And a nisayon takes you beyond that. That's what a test is. He's asking you to go beyond not just what you never knew about. He's asking you certainly to reveal all of that, but he's taking you further. He's asking you for something that is utterly impossible. Of course, again, if that happens, then the word nisayon, based on miracle, will be true, and you'll grow, and that's genuine growth, and that's unlimited growth. Because what happens is when you get there, he's going to give you another one, yet again impossible. And when you grow to that, and you become that, he's going to give you another one. And life's not fun. That's what it is. Now, what does this mean? How does it work? If it's impossible, how's it done? Let's try and understand. Isn't there a contradiction here? When many sources say that he never gives you a test that you're not capable of, what does that mean? Let's try and work through it. Now we want to reach here into a deeper area, the transcendent area, beyond what is given to young people as this mechanical, psychological type of answer, much more essential level. The Gemara says the following thing. Where is this discussed in the Talmud? The Gemara says this. You know that King David, David HaMelech, had a test. He was tested with Bathsheba, had a test with a woman. In fact, this test, David is the extension of the Mashiach. He is the extension of Adam HaRishon, Adam, and the precursor of the Mashiach. Yes, you're familiar with that. The sources say that the word Adam is Aleph Talad Mem. It actually spells Adam David Mashiach. Right? David is an extension of Adam. Adam lived for 930 years. David was the 70 years that Adam gave up of his 1,000 years so that David could live. Right? He's just an extension of the Neshama of Adam HaRishon. And in fact, he is the who David Ba'atzmo, it says about the Mashiach. We said that only a couple of weeks ago in the Rosh Hashanah. Who David Ba'atzmo, he, the Mashiach, is David. Adam, David, Mashiach is one neshama. There's three manifestations, 3 points in history, but it's one neshama. When David is tested, you have to understand, this is not just a test. When the Gemara talks about his test with Bathsheba, it's not just describing a man's test with a woman. It's describing the cosmic completion of the test that Adam was faced with when he was created. He was given a test of not eating from a certain fruit. He failed. David was being given a test later, which was the opportunity to complete the cycle, close the circle. I'm talking about a particulate and finite particular test. We're talking about an opportunity to finish history, to bring it to its fruition, to be the messianic fulfillment of what Adam HaRishon was. I'm talking about some test here. What was the nature of this test? So this is what happened. It's very hard things to understand here. It takes a lot of concentration. Let's try and work it out together. He says like this. David said one day, it happened to be the day, the night of which he was tested with Bathsheba. That's the afternoon, late afternoon that he saw her. And that night the whole incident occurred, which was where he was tested and in fact where he failed. What happened on that fateful day before his test was given to him was the following incident. The Gemara says that he said to Hashem, very, very difficult things to understand. David said, Hashem, God, why does the Jewish people say, Elokei Abraham, Elokei Yitzchak, and Elokei Yaakov, but we don't say Elokei David? Why do the Jewish people say, God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob, but we don't say God of David? Meaning, What have I missed? What do I lack? What have I not done for you? Where am I incomplete? Right? Let's understand carefully. First thing to, which I presume in this educated and elevated audience is not necessary, or just repeat it for completeness, is that David was not asking in pride. We're talking about one of the cosmically great neshamas of all of existence. David's particular characteristic, particular spiritual characteristic, was that he had conquered pride. The whole concept of David is that he's a human being who has nothing of his own ego. The Zohar says about David, Leis lei migar mei klum, he has nothing of his own. He's the human neshama, is an entirely empty vessel, he has nothing of his own at all. Nothing, he emptied himself of all ego, right? Libi chalal bekirbi means partly this, that my soul is empty within me, it means other things as well. Here's the human soul who has utterly conquered ego and is utterly conquered pride. You're not asking Hashem. You have to understand. You know that the Medaktikim say that David is Dalet Vav Dalet. But that means negation of ego. Dalet in Hebrew always means poverty. Dal in Hebrew means having nothing, right? Dal means lacking, without, poverty stricken. Dalet means the man who's characterized by the letter of nothingness. Vav is always the letter of Hesopha. It's the letter of addition. Vav in Hebrew means and, conjunction. The Kabbalists say that the Vav is a straight line because it's a channel from the higher world to the lower world. It's the ultimate connection in the world. In modern in Hebrew, Vav means a hook. Vav, which is spelled Vav Vav, which is the bonding of the same thing with itself, means a hook. A hook is that which bonds. Right? So Vav always means the connection. It means David starts as nothing, he's connected to the ultimate reality, poured into him the total expanse of all existence, shown it and given it, and he still at the end remains the same Talmud that he was before. Completely unchanged, utter humility remains. Incidentally, the arch enemy of David in the world is Gog. The war of Gog and Magog, right? The king who comes to battle David in his messianic manifestation is Gog. Gog is Gimel Vav Gimel, no accident. Gimel is a Hebrew letter that means full of yourself, right? Overflowing with content, self-inflated individual. Vav, he's connected with the reality, showed everything and given everything and made absolutely clear, and he remains the same self-inflated, egotistical individual at the end that he was before. That's the polarity. Again, in the words, in the words. David is the one who has nothing. He comes to the world to demonstrate that he's entirely empty. You know, one of the fascinating questions about David as a Mashiach is that why does Hashem send us the Mashiach at the end of history? Why does he send us Mashiach when he himself manifests on earth? You ever think about that problem? You know, it says that when the Mashiach comes, it says that Hashem's presence will cover the earth, kamayim layam machatzim, like water covers the ocean. Umallah ha'aretz daya, says the world will be full with knowledge of Hashem. Yet God's presence, Hashem's presence, will fill the earth tangibly. Who needs Mashiach then? You ever think about that problem? Who needs him then? Now when we need him. If you left the system to me to design, if they asked me to design history, I would have given us Mashiach now. I would have, you know, excused him of his duties in the final phase when Hashem does it all himself. Can you see the problem? Now's when we need him. Why does Hashem keep him? It doesn't manifest in history. And at that phase in history where Hashem's presence is tangibly manifest on earth, and the whole idea of Judaism is that it relates to Hashem directly. We don't go through intermediaries. That's anathema to us. So how come in the final perfect version here of history, final perfect version of the world's existence, there's Mashiach? But the answer is marvelous to understand, obvious as well to anybody who thinks about it. He said, when Hashem's presence manifests on earth, it's not only that he'll be manifesting correctly, so will we. It's a bad mistake to think that in the Messianic age, Hashem's presence will manifest with perfect clarity on earth, but human beings are still going to be human beings. We're going to be perfect too. The human dimension is also going to manifest itself perfectly. He's going to come down and meet a suitable bride. Bride and groom are going to match each other perfectly. Just Hashem's presence will glow and manifest with perfection on earth, so too will the manifestation of a human being. You know what Mashiach is? He's a perfect human being, that's what he is. He's a representative of what it means to be correctly disposed as a human. You know what he'll be? He'll be the most powerful, absolutely unilateral, cosmically powerful individual to ever live. Total autonomy. Rule the earth, not just a country or an empire. Completely uncontested, absolute power over the whole earth. And he'll show that he's nothing. That's a human being. That's the purpose of Mashiach. The purpose of Mashiach is to be a human being who is completely unlimited, who has the reason to have an ego that extends beyond all description, and he'll show that he has none. That's what Mashiach will be. That's why he'll manifest then. And that's why the relationship will be perfect. But David is he. David is the one who shows that he has nothing. Let me go and make klum. So he stands up in front of Hashem and he says, Hashem, why don't we say the God of David? What have I left undone? I'm ready to die for you. What do you want from me? You want to kill me? I'll go through anything for you. You know that, again, the Kabbalistic sources say that the world stands on four legs. Or some sources describe the mystical chariot. Again, these things are beyond us. But the chariot has four poles, four corners. And the four polarities of the world are constituted by Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, and David. The first come the three Avos, the triad that begins Torah, the Jewish people. And the completion is David, who brings it all to its fruition, its fulfillment. And David knew that. So he stood there and he said, Hashem, he knew he was the anointed one of Hashem. He stood and he said, what have I undone? I must have left some stone unturned. And Hashem answered him those incredible and faithful words. The Gemara says that Hashem said to him, reason. The reason that the Jewish people say, Elokei Abraham, Elokei Yitzchak, and Elokei Yaakov, is because they were tested. You've never been tested. So David said immediately, Hashem, Chaneini na v'naseini, test me! And that's where he failed. That's where he failed.
May not ask for tests. Not allowed to ask for tests.
What's going on? In depth, you have to appreciate was being tested. And Hashem said to him, they haven't been tested, they've been tested and you haven't. That was his moment of test. Hashem was saying to him,
don't say anything.
Don't ask for a test. You're not allowed to ask for a test. The fundamental failure in tests is to ask for them. You're not here criticizing at our level. You're talking about at his cosmic and almost infinite level. His test was, they were tested, and I'm testing you by asking you to remain silent. But he didn't pick it up. And he was so burning with the love of Hashem, and so aflame with his desire to bring out all that he was in. Well, do it, test me. What do you want from me? Put me through anything. And that's where he failed. Let's work through this. Slowly, one step at a time. First of all, you see that the result of a test, incredibly, and again, this goes into the deeper and the mystical, but let's express it as best we can. You see that the result of a test is that Hashem's name is set together with yours. What you see? Elokei Abraham. The God of Abraham. Why? Because he was tested. That's what the Gemara is saying. Your name's not set together with mine because you've never been tested. You see that the result of being put through the fire of an ordeal and going through the fire is that you come out the other side and your name and his are said together. What does this mean? Do you know what it means to say Hashem's name in the same breath as yours? You know what that means? There's no greater contradiction than putting together the finite and infinite. Do you know what it means, Elokei Abraham? You begin to get some concept of what's when Elokei Abraham means the God of Abraham. Do you know what that means? It means that as if to say he's personal, there's a personal relationship. Do you know what it means? It means that when Avraham Avinu goes through a test and Hashem attaches his name to him, it means that the essence of what he is, you know that a name is always essence. In Torah, a name always means, it should be painfully obvious by now, that a word is always the essence of the thing it describes. But a name is a description of essence. And that's what a name is. The word shame, by the way, is the root of the word neshama, in case you didn't pick it up. Neshama, which means the soul of the matter, the depth of its essence and reality. That's what its name is. And in case you didn't pick it up either, what's our word that we use for the next world? Shamayim. Shamayim doesn't mean the sky. Shamayim means, you know what it means? It means shamim. All the there's that you can point to that are the end of the journey, and it's the same word as the name. Because what you get to in the final there is who you really are. And what you get to in the final end of the real journey is what you really are and what he really is. And it's one thing. So when Hashem puts his name together with yours in the world, it means that you brought him into existence. That there's a bond of essence here, where the essence of what you are and the essence of what his manifestation is, that they hand in hand. It means that when Avraham Avinu goes through a test and is prepared to kill his son, and he goes through the actions that are required, suddenly he's not walking alone. Suddenly the world sees that he walks together with Hashem, and that the names are said in the same breath, which is impossible to conceive. What does this mean? Let's try and make it tangible. Let's try and bring it home into our consciousness. Listen well. Stay with me well. The nature of an ordeal is that you are being asked to do the impossible. That's what it is. Not that you never realized before, it's a little bit more difficult, it's been hidden from you, you didn't realize, it needs a bull to show. Talking about something that is impossible. Not adrenaline, and not a surge of energy, and not talking about the impossible. He's asking you to do that which is impossible. And when it happens, it'll be a miracle. You know how? How can he ask you to do the impossible? You can't do the impossible. You cannot do it, by definition. The definition of the impossible is that which you cannot do. And the answer is, you cannot do it. But he can. And what you do when you go through a test, a real test, is that he asks you for the impossible, and you have to do it, and then he carries you through, and then his name manifests, because your name manifests. Again, stay carefully with me. And how does it happen? Because when you leap, knowing that it's impossible, what you're saying is, look, it's not me. That's what you're saying. Let's get it clear. Stay with me carefully. I don't see too many enlightened faces. Let's make it graphic. You walk out of here this evening. Walking down the road, pensive, I'll try to give you something to think about this evening. Walking down the road thinking. Big hand taps you on the shoulder. Big hand. And you turn around and you're facing the creator of the world. If it happens to you, see me privately. Because today we don't live in a generation of prophecy. The Gemara says that now prophecy, we only have in children and dogs, and people are insane. Vestige of the prophecy. So we don't have it. But imagine that you lived in the age of prophecy. You're walking down the road, you turn around, you're facing... Now, there's no hallucinations. There's no illusions. This is not a dream. Let's leave all that stuff out. Talking to Hashem. He says, look, I'd like you to do me a favor. Anything you say? I presume you'd say that, wouldn't you? So I'd like you to take a little trip tomorrow down to the highest mountain in Britain. And climb to the top, and you'll see a chasm yawning beneath you, 5,000 foot drop with jagged rocks at the bottom. I want you to jump. But don't worry, I'll catch you. You'd take a trip, wouldn't you? Take a trip, wouldn't you? Of course you would. Take a trip the next day. Climb up to the summit. You walk over to the edge. Long way down. And you'd go... No? Silence. Now you know you have to do this. You didn't make this up. You know who you're dealing with. You know who's going to catch you. You going to do this? A test means that he asks you to do that, which you know you have to do. Tests in Judaism are not things that you make up yourself. Now, you didn't get into this because you chanted for 6 hours or mumbled some formula or somebody bamboozled you into believing something. That's not Yiddishkeit. Ordeals in Torah begin with knowledge, absolute knowledge. The question is, I know I have to do it, but it's impossible. That's the problem. We'll work through this slowly. So you stand there on the edge and you say, well, look, it's impossible. From here to there, it's just impossible. That's impossible. Not just not enough adrenaline, it's impossible, I can never do that. And Hashem says, right, absolutely impossible, now jump. Yeah, but it'll be reasonable, it's not possible for me. And he says, yep, that's what I want from you. So what happens? You jump. If you succeed in your test, you leap. And what happens is you find yourself an impossible distance away, and you say, but that couldn't be me. That was impossible. If by definition it was impossible and it happened, then by definition someone else did it. You brought him into revelation in the world, but you only brought him into the world because you did that which was impossible. He doesn't pick you up and carry you over if you don't leap. When you leap the impossible leap, he doesn't let you down. But only when you leap the leap. If you stand there and go like this, it doesn't work that way. You have to leap beyond all hope of recovery. You do this only because he tells you. We're not talking about coming up with that idea yourself. Abraham didn't decide to slit his son's throat because he thought it would be a nice thing to do and probably go down in history as... He only did it because Hashem gave him a direct command. We're not talking about theory. But our direct commands in this generation are very, very vague. We have a problem with doubt. It's another problem. For another time, we have to discuss our problem. Our problem is that the commands aren't clear. Most of us feel that if only he gave me a clear command, I'd go through fire for him. I have no limitations. I have the courage. The problem is I don't know I'm moving the right direction. That's not my problem. That's another issue. But in theory, at root, and there's an answer to it in our generation as well. But let's clarify the principle. The principle is that in Torah, ordeals begin with knowledge. But the test is, will you go through it, even though you know you have to because it's impossible? And a real test means you do what he asks because you know you have to do it. The consequence has got nothing to do with you. The author of Kelm used to say, do not ask if a thing is possible. Ask only if it's necessary. Isn't that beautiful? Sometimes, what's it going to do with you if it's possible? It's going to do with you, it's his problem. Is it necessary? Yeah, do it. Ah, it's impossible. The things that have been built in the world that are real things were things that weren't possible before. Yeah, ask him if it's possible. Nothing would have gotten done. We're the people of the impossible. That's who we are. So let's get it clear. What happens is that the partnership that's established between you and him, the reason that your name is said with his, is because two essences made this thing happen. There's the movement that you performed, which is impossible, and there's the result that he performed that's his.
It was impossible. And therefore there's an equal partnership. An incredible, inexpressible idea. There's an equal partnership. He couldn't have manifested in the world if not on your shoulders. The reason that he appears in the world is because a human being took the leap. Your leap into the impossible, showing your connection, showing that you bring him in, showing that you aren't anything, it's all him. He shows that it's all you. He makes it clear that you got across because you leaped. Masilis Yesharim says, "Chilasoi avoda v'soifo gemul." The process always is, the beginning is work and the end is a gift. The gift got no proportion to the work. Do you know what the Chazal says? The Chazal said that if a person tells you that he labored and found, you should believe him. If a person says that he found a spiritual result without any work, you shouldn't believe him. But if a person says, Yagati umatsati, means yagir, means labor, umatsati, I found the result, you should believe him. If a person labors, you achieve. You work, you achieve. But listen to the words, they're so beautiful. So hear carefully the words of the sages. Yagati umatsati means, I made an effort and I found. You know what the right verb should have been in Hebrew? Yagir, which means labor, should have been followed by paalti, hisagti, asiti, words that mean I did it, I made it. You know what a metzia is in Hebrew? By definition, a metzia is an unexpected find. You know what a metzia is? The definition of a metzia is you're walking along, you stumble over something, you look down, you find something that was unexpected. What do you mean unexpected? You just worked for it, didn't you? Got nothing to do with the work. Isn't that beautiful? The concept is you worked for it. You worked very hard. And because you worked, the result happened. But the result had nothing to do with the work. It was completely out of proportion. Got nothing to do with it. It's still a metzias. You don't get no metzias unless you do the work. But when you do the work, you get something you couldn't have dreamed of. And of course, that's why the 10th step takes you beyond what was possible before. Otherwise, you'd always be moving in the same circle. No, you move to the limit of your circle, then he takes you into another one. That's the gift. Now you move in that circle, then he takes you to another one. And that's why there's no limit, it's because he's operating. But he only operates if you do. He's your shadow. You make the impossible attempt, he makes the impossible result. That's what faith means. Faith doesn't mean bamboozling yourself into doing something that's vague or doubtful. That's not faith, that's stupidity. Faith means doing that which is logical and makes sense. Torah begins with critical analysis, with logic, with a verified and verifiable history, with prophetic instruction and clear... That's not the problem. The problem is, you're going to go through with it? Are you going to do it even though it's impossible? And what happens is, when you do the impossible, your name and his are said. You know the example, keep you too late. The Gemara says, give you an example. Just see it through. The Gemara says that Shimon ben Shetach, one of the great sages of the generation of the Tanoim, before... The Gemara says he once bought a donkey from a non-Jew, and when the animal arrived, it had a very precious jewel attached, which was unknown to the non-Jew that had happened. And he could have kept it, and been rich. He sent it back. He sent his students to take this jewel back to the non-Jew, and he sent it with a message, I bought a donkey, I didn't buy a jewel. When the non-Jew received his jewel back, an exclamation burst forth from him. You know what the exclamation was? Baruch Elokei Shimon ben Shetach. Blessed is the God of this Jew. He didn't say, blessed is this Jew, or he's a great man. He said, Baruch Elokei Shimon ben Shetach. He put God's name together with the name of this individual. Why? Why? Because when a human being does that, which is not natural, which no animal does, which no part of the natural world does, is give away something that it could have had. So then you manifest that there is something here that's not part of the natural, becomes visible, and the non-Jew looking on sees that this is not a natural animal. Since no animal does this, and this just happened, this human being, this Jew, has revealed on earth that he's connected to something that transcends the natural, and he expresses it, Baruch Elokei Shimon ben Shetach. It's this Jew doing something that's impossible naturally that shows me that there's something else in the world. Shimon ben Shetach brings Hashem's presence into the world. He makes a goy. He makes this non-Jew recognize the fact that there's... That's what an ordeal is. It challenges you to do that which goes beyond the bounds of the natural. Goes into the supernatural. And he sees that it happens. And his name is there. That's what it is. When Hashem tells him to take his son and kill him, right, let's understand. Is Hashem asking him to do something that's difficult, that he's never realized before? Or is he asking him to do something that's impossible? Is it difficult? Is it something that you couldn't do voluntarily, but when the bull racing after you, you'll squeeze yourself to do it? Or is he asking him for something impossible? The commentaries make clear that Hashem was asking him for that which is utterly impossible. And not for the usual reason, by the way. Most beginners and children will usually tell you, you know why it was impossible for Avraham Avinu to kill his son? Because he loved him so much. It's the boy that he waited 100 years for. And he taught the whole world that you don't kill people, it's wrong. And Hashem promised him that the whole Jewish people would come forth from this boy. How could he possibly kill him? It was very, very, very difficult. That's for children. Jews throughout the ages have done things like that. They've managed. Avraham Avinu's self-control was supreme. His emotions were not the problem. It wasn't that he couldn't handle it emotionally. On the contrary, Mephoshim said that when Hashem said, stop, don't kill him, he said, please, please. And Hashem said, no, I don't want him killed. He said, please, let me draw some blood. What's going on? It's not the problem. The Gemara doesn't say that. The Gemara says that when he walked towards that Akedah, and he had his son with him, and he was going to slit his throat and kill him, he knew that Hashem didn't want it. That's the problem. He knew that it was impossible. Why? The way the Gemara puts it is very, very beautiful. The Gemara says, "Asher loy chafatzti." It's a pasuk in Tehillim. "Asher loy chafatzti v'loy alsa al libi," which translated loosely into English means "which never occurred to me." Which means, the Gemara says that this pasuk is referring to the Akedah, the killing of Yitzchak. When Hashem commanded him to kill Isaac, it was something that he never really intended. Never even occurred to me that he should kill him. And we know, of course, that he never intended it. After all, at the last moment when he tried to do it, Hashem revealed to him that it was not to be. It means this: as he walked towards that binding of his son with a knife on him, he knew, as the beloved knows the heart of the beloved, that this was impossible. He knew that Hashem did not want it. That Hashem did not want this thing. Do you know what that means? Picture the scene. Yitzchak is on the Mizbech, he's tied up. Avraham Avinu takes his head and extends his neck, takes a sharp knife, and is about to kill him, slit his throat. Why? Because Hashem has told him to do it. He didn't make this up, Hashem told him. He's about to carry out what Hashem tells him to do, but he knows that Hashem doesn't want him to do this thing. He knows that it's impossible, not emotionally impossible, he knows that it's impossible, Hashem doesn't want it. Not because human logic, because Hashem doesn't want it! And Hashem looks down at him and says, "You're absolutely right, I don't want it. Now kill him anyway." That's impossible. It wasn't the emotion. It was his mind. He had to give up his mind. He had to give up everything, all thought. That's impossible. He had to carry out the contradiction in his own. Hashem said, no, absolutely. And you know what the result was? It's impossibility. You know what the Midrash says? That when Yitzchak got down off the Mizbech and walked away, because his life was spared, you know what remained on the Mizbech? A pile of his own ash. The Midrash says, Ephro shall Yitzchak munach lefanai. The ashes of the burning of Yitzchak, not the ashes of the ram, the ashes of Yitzchak are in front of him. Do you know what it means? Do you know what it means? You have to understand this. Yitzchak got off the Mizbech and walked away. You know what his next action was? He went off to get married. It was the beginning of the Jewish people. And he left behind the ashes of his own incineration. You know what it means? That the Jewish people are a people who live in the world after having died. That's who we are. We begin where the impossible ends. That's what it means. Avraham Avinu did an impossible action. The impossible result occurred. You know, the Arizal, the great Kabbalistic master, says that the word Yitzchak, if you spell it out, it spells Kate Chai. You know what that means? Death in life. That's what it means. It means going into the next world while yet in this one. And that's what the Jew is. We begin where despair ends. We became a transcendent people that are still here, although none of them are, only because we began in an act of a human being acquiring his own physical reality. And the beautiful symbolism is that as he acquires his own manhood, his own essence, his own existence, he goes off to get married. Yet the result of this archaic sense, the result of this archaic, this result of being a man who lives in the world after being shechted, who lives in this world and the next at the same time, is that he fathers the Jewish people who live in this world and the next at the same time. That's what it means. You do the impossible action, this tenth of his test, you do that, and Hashem sees to it that it goes through. An impossible result occurs. And that means Avraham Avinu, his name is said with Hashem. Ooh, that's the result. Incidentally, we began with the Nisayon of this Parsha. This isn't the Akedah, this Parsha is Lech Lecha. You know what Lech Lecha means? Now, hopefully we can have a little bit more insight into it. Lech Lecha, Hashem said to him like this, Lech Lecha, go, leave your place, leave your birthplace, your father's house, your land, to the land which I will show you. Again, we're not children. We're not learning Pshat here.
Lovely Nechumash on a six-year-old devil, which basically means go from the land of wherever it is to the land of Israel, Canaan. We're not talking about that. We're talking about a spiritual journey. Lech Lecha means leave you. Leave who you are now. That's what it means. And go to the person you will be. Yes, that's what it means. Of course it means a physical journey. We're not. But Torah always means on a higher level. The instruction was, go to yourself. Lech Lecha. Go to what who you must be and who you must be. Now the question becomes, why didn't he tell him where? He said to him, go from exactly where you are. But where to? You'll see when you get there. Ha'aretz asher ar'eka. I'll show you when you're there. The Mephoshim struggled with this. The commentary struggled with this. Why didn't he tell him where? He wants him to undertake a journey, right? It's going to be difficult. It's going to be difficult. Tell him, go from here to there. It's the instruction. Go. When you get there, you'll see. You know why? Please, stay with me carefully. The fact that you must leave is absolutely plain. The leaping off in an ordeal that will lead to the greater person that you must become, that's absolutely clear. Starts with logic and knowledge. But the person that you will become is not visible from where you are. The result can't be seen from where you are. You have to leap first. And when there's no going back and you're completely vulnerable, then he'll show you what you're going to become. You know why? Because if he'll show you what you're going to become where you are now, you'll only see a distorted and shrunken version of it since you aren't there yet. You cannot be shown it where you are now. Do you understand? Yeah. Anyone out there? If he would take you and say, look, you have to leap and become a partner with me in something greater, how can he show you that? How can he show you that? You don't have the capacity. You don't have the clue. You don't have the vessel. You don't have the vessel. You can't do that. First, you have to break what it is that you are. And then you'll be able to see what it... You know, if you take a prism of glass and you imprison someone in the prism. Yes, imagine someone locked in a prism and you shine white light upon him. The person is looking up, he doesn't see the white light, he sees it broken into its colours. Correct? You know that? You want him to see the white light very badly, so you shine it more and more strongly, but he'll never see that until he breaks the prism. If Hashem would tell him where he's going, then it would be a lie. It would be a lie. If it could be apprehended and grasped at his present level, it would be subject to his present limitations. Hashem says to him, first you break who you are now. You lech lecha, you go. When you get there, you'll see what it is. That's the nature of an ordeal. The result is out of sight for you now. It's a precipice and a gap that's impossible. You can't even see where it is. You've no concept of what you will become. But you leap from here and I'll take you there. That's why it's one of his great tests. Incidentally, those of you who are involved in teaching, or you work with secular Jews, or especially if you work with skeptics and cynics, affirmed atheists and secularists, sometimes they argue with you like this. They say, you religious people, you're so narrow. So narrow. You're so chicken. You just got mapped out from one guaranteed step to the next. That's all. It's no thinking. There's no heroism. There's no exploration. So one step to the next. It's all rules. You follow the rules. Me? I'm prepared to go anywhere. I go where the truth leads. In my secular conception, I'm on a process of discovery. Well, whatever I... You know what the truth is? The path, of course you can be narrow. You can be a religious Jew and be narrow. Oh, absolutely. You can be using it as a crutch and you can be a groupie in Torah just like you can in anything else. But that's not Ruchnias. That's not the spiritual path. The spiritual path is that you use Torah to leap yourself into dimensions that are greater than you can begin to understand. Of course you do it with logic and guidance and you need a Rebbe and it has to be based on history. We're not talking about leaping ridiculous leaps. It's not for us. But you have to be prepared to make that change before you know where it will take you. That's what faith means. That's the blindness of our faith. It's not that you do something blind. You do something with your eyes open, but the result is out of sight at the moment. That's what it is. There's a great heroism in that. Are you prepared to leave where you are now before you know where you'll get? Are you prepared to leave the security of your present level? Have you got the courage for that? Even though you might have been doing it all your life and you may be used to it and you may be secure, are you prepared to leave that? But the secularist is arguing with you. You know what he's telling you? He goes wherever the truth leads. As long as it's in the boundaries of his secular reality. Oh, one second. He's predetermined the playing field, hasn't he? He said that as long as it's within the provable scientific objective physical things. What kind of heroism is that? He'll go anywhere the truth leads. As long as it's here, right? Does the truth lead him into that which is spiritual and this whole pathway? No, but he defines it as unreal in the first place. You hear what's going on here?
Let's finish. Let's get back to the beginning and try and close the circle. Let's finish with David. What happened with David and Bathsheba? What happened with him? When David asked to be tested, that's when he said, "V'chaneni nav v'naseni, test me." But understand what's happening. What Hashem was saying to him was, your characteristic is utter humility. You have nothing of your own, and that's what you're here to teach the world. Your opportunity here is to correct the mistake of Adam Rishon. I asked him to swallow his own abilities. You see the parallel? I said to him, don't eat the fruit of that tree. Don't eat the fruit of that tree. You know what I was asking him to do? Not to prove his greatness. I was asking him to swallow and not manifest his free will. You know what Adam's ordeal was? His ordeal was, you've made me Hashem, you've made me unreal in my power, you've made me cosmic. Do you know that the Midrash says that the angels tried to worship him, they couldn't tell the difference? You know that? The angels couldn't tell the difference between him and his creator. They wanted to worship him. Do you know how great he was? So he looked around and he said, look, you've given me this incredible power. Surely you want me to lift the world? Surely you want me to do it for you? And Hashem said, I know it looks that way, but I'm asking you to let me do it. Just remain passive. Don't try to prove anything. Give back your free will to me. I'll fly this planet. You be my passenger. And he said, but you can't mean that. You didn't give me this power for nothing. You didn't give it to me for nothing. You gave it to me for a purpose, right? You don't want me to prove my love for you? I'll go through anything for you. Ah, you tell me that if I do this, I'll die, and I'll bring the world into turmoil and torture and brutality. I'll do that for you. I want to prove it for you. I live for you. I'll go through anything for you. Surely that's what you want. Hashem said to him, I know what you're thinking, but let me do it. Just give it up to me. And he couldn't do it. Couldn't do it. Hashem said, I'm giving you two roads. One is the easy and safe road home. The other road is a tremendous ordeal. And I know you think you can go down that road and battle it and win and go through all the consequences, and I know you're doing it for me, but I don't want that. I want a much bigger test from you, a much bigger thing. I want you to give everything that you are to me, even your opportunities to prove what you could have been. Give it back to me. Couldn't do it. So Hashem said to David, here's your opportunity. And he set him up. He said to him, you know how we say the God of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, Abraham, Yitzchak, Yaakov, because they were tested and you haven't been tested. What he was saying was, let me do it. And he said, let me do it. And that's where he failed. You see, when you ask for a test, you know what characteristic you're breaking? You know which middah, which trait of the personality you're controverting? Pride. That's what it is. Give me a test, I'll show you. Test me, I'll show you. Nobody asks for a test that they think they're going to fail. Nobody asks for a test that they think they're going to fail. Of course David meant it for Hashem. So did Adam Rishon. Of course he meant it for the highest reasons. Of course. But when you ask to be tested, there has to be some degree of a percent, of a millionth, of a billionth, of a something of I'll do it. And the whole point of proving, doing, manifesting what history is here to demonstrate is that you nothing, it's all him. You provide the totally emptied vessel so that he can totally fill it. The greatest human being who ever lived was Moshe Rabbeinu. And the Torah says about him is that he was the humblest. When you empty yourself totally of all ego, then he can fill you totally. But as long as you're showing how much you are, you keep him away. Like Rav Simcha used to say, the world is full of light except where we cast the shadows. That's your problem. You're trying to shine the light, but you're getting in the way. And you know what the response is to that? You know what the only response is to asking for a test? Failure. When the problem is that you're trying to prove that you have a capacity, and the whole point of a test is to show that you're nothing and he's everything, the only logical response, the only solution, is failure. There are sources that say that David failed deliberately after he realized what he'd done. Imagine if you would have asked for a test and then passed it. That's humility. That proves that it's all Hashem and not me. Rabbi Miller from Gates said it's a beautiful illustration of this principle. Beautiful illustration. He describes the scene of a teacher walking into a classroom.
Imagine you have a classroom of little children, and among the class you have one precocious, real, forward, obnoxious, you wouldn't know about this, doesn't happen in England, but happens in some parts of the world. You have this really forward little child. This kind of child, this child always says, "Teacher, ask me, I'll definitely know." Teacher walks into the class one day and she says, "Children, I'm going to ask you a question. Teacher, ask me, I'll definitely know." If the teacher asks that child a question and the child answers, she'll make his problem worse. And if she asks him a difficult question and he answers, she'll make his problem much worse. She has to ask a question that the child cannot answer. That's the only solution. And so when David said, "Test me," that was the test, and it had just been failed. What happened with Bathsheba was something else. Completely. It was an opportunity, in fact, to correct and regain humility. It needs more now. But that's it. So in summary, what have we learned? We've learned in the sweep of history, all the way from the first ordeal that the human being was ever faced with, all the way through, see it manifest in David, whose name is not yet said together with Hashem's, that was not yet the time, will be, it's Hashem soon, will be said again, and it will be a revelation of what the human being is capable of doing, namely, of emptying ourselves completely of ego, and being able to admit that it's not us, that it's him, and that will be our greatness, of course. That is what it is. And therefore, the concept of Nisayon, of ordeals, is the concept of, at the first level, bringing out that which was hidden before, but it's more than that, it's bringing out or getting to, rising to a level that is truly miraculous. It's a level that you weren't capable of before, no matter what the pressure. And emotionally, when you're faced with an ordeal, and it's a real one, and you feel that it's too big for you, you may be right. If it's a real test and you didn't choose it yourself, and it comes with the enormity of feeling that this is bigger than you, and yet you know that Hashem always guarantees that He never gives a test that you cannot succeed, you have to understand that. It doesn't mean that this is within your capacity. That doesn't mean that. Your sensation that it's bigger than you and too hard for you is absolutely right, but it comes with a watertight guarantee that despite being impossible, if you move into it, He will lift you into the impossible dimension. That will be the partnership, and that's when you'll feel a Father's hands lifting you over that impossible chasm. That's what it means. And therefore, we're not proof by the fact that it feels impossible. On the contrary, that's what you should relish. When you get into a situation that feels impossible, you didn't choose it yourself, of course. You ask to be tested. There's no guarantees. You ask to be tested. No, it's a failure already. You're waiting to test to prove what you're made of. You will prove what you're made of. It's exactly what will happen. But when you get given a test that you did not ask for, and it feels too big for you, and in fact, if you know it's too big for you, exactly, that's a real test. It doesn't put you off. Here's your opportunity to let Him take over. You have to admit that you have to leap. Don't sit back and wait. You have to do what you're being asked to do. It may feel like a superhuman effort. The fact that you can't judge whether the result will take place, that's not your problem. Your problem is doing what you have to do. And therefore, that's the concept. Lech Lecha means walk, leave who you are now, and walk towards that person which is the true and deep and correct essence of what you should be.